Real too. I was asking you about sport organised for the boys. I was wondering if perhaps you had a sporting matches against band boys in other regiments or anything of that sort.
We didn't have any competitive matches for the boys, but each day we were required during physical recreation either to go for a run, a cross-country run, supervised by one of the sports instructors. We would have games of football organized where we would join in together. Not very active, mind you, there were only a few of us, but we would be encouraged to go swimming perhaps and take part in the various events swimming. So we were getting, and also we did have a chance under the tuition of some of our other sportsmen of taking part in tennis. We were allowed on the tennis courts, and providing that we could hit a ball reasonably well, we were encouraged to take part in all kinds of sports within reason, bearing in mind we weren't allowed to mix basically with the normal trooper.
You're mentioning in your account that the regiment had been mechanised quite early in 1935. What sort of tanks did it have when you joined?
Well, the regiment were mechanised in 1935 at Hounslow before they went to Egypt. When I joined the regiment, we were a fully mechanised regiment, and the tanks that the regiment had was a Mark 6B tank, which was quite an antiquated little tank, but in those days it was considered a formidable object. Later it was to prove that a 0.5 bullet would go through the vehicle. So as a tank, although at the time we didn't know it, it wasn't very much of an armoured vehicle to fight in.
Did you have anything to do with the tanks when you were in your boy service?
No, we were kept completely away from the tanks. We used to watch the various manoeuvres because the tank parks were quite close to the barracks, and we would watch the tanks go out on exercises across the desert, but we had little or nothing to do with the tanks.
You mentioned that they'd got rid of the horses. Was there still an interest in horses and riding in the regiment
Very
when you
much
joined it?
so. Most of our cavalrymen were horsemen. In fact, they joined from quite illustrious people. Nearly all the officers came from quite good backgrounds, and in most cases used to ride daily. So when they joined the regiment, this continued, and the regiment had a very good polo section, and officers were encouraged to practice their horse riding almost daily, and in fact took part in many gymkhanas and various horse trials that were held locally. Especially in Egypt, there was a huge European community who encouraged horsemanship in every form.
Were you encouraged to take any interest in horsemanship?
Not really, no. It would have been, I think it would have been a bit risky to try the boys to learn horses. We had enough to do with learning to play our instruments, and consequently, we didn't come in contact with the horse riding portion of our regiment.
Now, you mentioned being supervised by NCOs. Did you have any contact with officers at all in this early stage?
We had a band president who was usually a major who was quite interested in our welfare. He would come and speak to us every few days to see if we had any grumbles. Of course, we never had a grumble, because if we did grumble, we would be, what shall I say, we would be regarded as rebels, and that would heap extra duties on us. So we accepted the fact that the band president, when visiting us, we usually held our tongue. But behind his back, we had many a grumble about the way the men used to treat us. Some of our senior bandsmen, when they'd finished their duties, used to take up card playing, solo and whist and nap, and they used to play for money in one little corner of the band room. And of course, when they got hungry and thirsty, who were called upon? The boys. Run to the canteen and get me a sandwich. Fetch me a beer. And although we weren't allowed to go to the canteen, to the beer section, even we usually managed to get what was required, and perhaps for maybe sixpence, we would run a long errand to fetch refreshments whilst these lads played card well into the night.
What was your pay at that stage? What happened to it?
Well, all I can remember is receiving 5 shillings a week. 5 shillings a week. Can you imagine that? And we had to buy, out of that, we had to buy our cleaning materials and polish. And at the end of the day, we had little or nothing for canteen visits. This is why our cooks used to be so generous to us. They knew that we were always hungry, and they would supply us with meals or sandwiches whenever the chance arose.
Now, the war broke out in September 1939. Had you had any idea that there was going to be a war before it started?
No, the declaration of war took us all by surprise. I think some of the officers knew that things were beginning to happen regarding the start of a war, but as bandsmen and band boys, we did not have an inkling. When war was finally declared, it was decided that the band boys should come home with the bandmaster to continue their musical studies in England. But there were two of us, two boys, stayed behind. We were nearly 17 and a half years old. So two of us decided to stay and go to duty. In other words, join the regiment, rather than to come home with the bandmaster to England.
Who was the other boy who decided to stay?
It was a young lad called Mortimer State. Funny name, Mortimer State. And he and I were great pals, and quite bravely we made a stand and declared that we would in fact stay with the regiment and take part in their duties.
Why did you decide that? What were your reasons for deciding to stay with the regiment rather than...
As I've stated before, I was very keen on my sport. And although war wasn't imminent, and I had no idea what it entailed, I was loath to leave the friends that I'd made in the sports teams. They used to look upon us as good mascots, I suppose, because they were always inviting us to join in a team game, and consequently we didn't want to forego this little luxury.
You said that you had no idea what it entailed. Once war had been declared, did you have any expectations about what was likely to happen?
When war was declared, there was great activity within the regiment. The vehicles were prepared for war. Stores were loaded onto lorries. Our tanks were made ready for war. And with a great flourish, off they went to war. The tanks were driven down to the local railway sidings and put on flats. And that was a great occasion. And as there were many tanks, this loading of tanks onto railway flats for transportation up to the Western Desert took place over a week or so. Vehicles went independently in convoy, and in fact the barrack rooms were almost deserted. There was some members left behind for various reasons. There were people who had been injured in accidents, people who were sick, some people who were not medically fit. But here again, you also had the element who would avoid any such duty. And they were the type of people who were left behind in the barracks. This was known as LOB, left out of battle.
Roughly how many were there left out of battle?
Well, perhaps, looking back, I should think about maybe a fifth of the regiment would have been left behind. There would be residual cooks, medical staff, telephone operators, regimental policemen. There would be quite a substantial people purely to make the base work. But on the other hand, you had the sick and those who didn't want to fight.
How did those who didn't want to fight manage to get included in being left out of battle?
Well, very many of them resurrected old troubles. Some would say they had bad backs, or they had various injuries. And of course, if there was any person suspect, he was held behind, he was held back, and made to see the medical specialists, who eventually decided whether or not they joined the regiment or stayed behind.
What were you doing then? Once the regiment's squadrons had gone off into the Western Desert, what were your duties?
The two of us, the two band boys who elected to stay, felt like fish out of water. We still continued to have to blow these trumpet calls, this time on a more frequent basis, every other day. And within a very short period of time, we were fed up to the teeth of this continual duty. And many of us, at least, and we often made requests to our orderly room to find us some other means of employment. And I think after about 3 or 4 months, I was especially fortunate because I received a posting for which I was greatly satisfied. At that time, coming into the country through the port of Suez or Port Tewfik, Liberty ships from the United States of America were bringing leased land equipment by way of tanks, guns, lorries, and stores were coming in by these huge boats, and almost daily these ships were arriving to help unload all these boats, it was necessary to implement a port unloading system. And therefore, in Suez, a detachment of about 20 persons were gathered together, consisting of a couple of officers and a couple of NCOs, but mainly drivers, gunners, wireless operators, and the like, with the sole aim of proceeding to the docks, going on board the ships, and preparing these items of equipment and stores for unloading.
What was your work mainly?
I was very fortunate. When I was left behind when the regiment went to war, I managed to obtain, with my co-pal, my other boy, we learned on the desert to drive a vehicle. Now this was quite easy because we didn't have to worry about streets or roads or obstacles. We just went on a nice open stretch of desert and we played around with these lorries until we learned to drive them.
Who actually taught you?
We were fortunate, as the person in charge of transport trusted us because he thought we were quite sensible, and we didn't receive any particular instruction. We were just told that we could take a 1500 weight lorry, a small lorry, and to learn to drive. Nowadays this would be impossible, but in those days, with the state that had been declared, chaos ensued everywhere. So we were given license to take this vehicle. This vehicle was, by the way, parked quite close to the edge of this strip of desert, and we were allowed to go along and drive it, learn to use the gears, learn to steer, and learn all about careful driving. And in this manner, we learnt quite quickly to drive.
Do you have any idea of roughly how long it took you to become competent?
Quite proficient. I should think about 3 weeks. Because we knew we wanted to drive, and as a youngster, it was normal for us to learn to drive. So we put heart and soul into it, and within 3 or 4 weeks, we had become quite good drivers. But then we now had to learn to drive in amongst other vehicles and on roads.
That's different, isn't it?
That's quite different, but we were sensible about it. I was 17, perhaps 17 and a half, and in those days, although not as forward as today, but we were sensible lads, and I took to driving quite well and liked it very much.
I imagine that when you were helping to unload at Port Tewfik, you had to drive all sorts of vehicles, not just lorries. What sort of vehicles did you drive at Port Tewfik?
It was a case of trial and error. We didn't have expert instructors down on the docks. Our NCOs knew we could drive reasonably well, so they would say to us, right, go on board that ship and get those vehicles from within the sides of the ships down below the derricks. So we would move the vehicles to the centre of the hold, where the ships, derricks and cranes would lift the vehicle out onto the docks. Some of us would move the ship, the vehicles and guns to this lifting position, whereas a few of us would be on the docks awaiting these vehicles to drive away. And once they were landed onto the quayside and unshackled, we would then checked them to see if they had enough petrol to enable us to drive them a short distance, perhaps a quarter of a mile, to some railway ramps at which were waiting railway flats, which were sideless wagons, onto which we drove these vehicles, and they were secured securely and taken from there to a big ordnance depot at Telekabir, which was perhaps 30 or 40 miles away, a big ordnance depot.
Did you ever have any mishaps with driving these strange and unfamiliar vehicles?
There were several mishaps. Fortunately, none of them seriously. We would perhaps bump into the side of the ship, perhaps wrongly. Little mistakes, but of course, by these small accidents happening, one learnt to avoid them. And quite soon, we were handling them like expert mechanics.
All done by practice, then.
All done by practice. And of course, we were keen. And of course, this unloading of these ships went on day and night in some cases until these ships were unloaded and returned to America for further loads. So we were continually at the docks and working down amongst the vehicles. We had lorries to start with, then small trucks, even Bren gun carriers. Now, the Bren gun carriers has caused us the most fun, because if you have ever driven a Bren gun carrier on cobbles, it was quite an experience. You had to use your steering tillers and brakes in a very delicate manner, or else you'd be swiveling around.
Well, you'd be rotating like a whirligig.
You'd be rotating like a whirligig. Mm. So you careful when you got into a Bren gun carrier, you knew that if you were too hard on the accelerator, it would shoot off uncontrollably. But then we knew this problem with them, so eventually we became quite cautious with the driving of these vehicles, and in fact learned to drive them very well.
It occurs to me that putting vehicles up ramps and onto flat cars must have been a rather delicate and skillful operation.
It is a skillful operation, but necessity is the mother of invention. There were very few troops around. Most of the troops, there were a lot of Egyptian and foreign labourers, but we were designated to handle this equipment, and this is what we did. We learnt quite quickly to drive these vehicles up to the railway ramps, and then through practice we learnt to align them straight before we drove them, and carefully drive them onto the flats. This exercise was quite different to when you loaded a tank or a Bren gun carrier onto a transporter, because if you drove onto a transporter, you were in a different situation, because as you drove up a transporter, you saw nothing but sky. So you had to be aligned absolutely correctly before you started to move. Whereas on these ramp flats, we were at least level and straight before we moved. So with a lot of care, and we did become quite good at it, we managed quite adequately to load these vehicles ready for transportation to the depot.
You mentioned that you had two officers in charge of this
detachment.
Port detachment. Were they Royal Engineers or Transport or
no, I think,
Service
I think,
Corps?
I think they were LAD, Light Aid Detachments, or
yes.
The origins of the Reaming.
Yes.
They were people from a mechanical section, but they interfered with us very little. They made sure that we had enough men to work a shift. If anybody took ill, a replacement was immediately put in to make up the numbers, and we worked in about groups of 10 at a time. We would go down, some of us would be working continually, and whilst we were waiting for vehicles to come off the boat, the other group would probably have refreshments and a meal. And then alternatively, whilst they were loading the tanks, we would have some refreshment, usually from the ship's crews. They would supply us with some nice meals, knowing full well that we needed and deserved it.
Where were you living while you were doing this work at Port Tewfik?
We were based in an army tented camp, perhaps maybe a mile to 2 miles from the docks, so we were right on hand. If a ship came in unexpectedly, we were given a half hour's warning to get ready to go down, and this could have happened any time during the night. Some nights we worked throughout the night unloading these ships, but there was always a high risk at that time, because to unload these ships safely we had to have a lot of light. Big arc lights were showing all night, and the Germans at that stage were running bombing trips and laying of magnetic mines down the Suez Canal. And the moment there was the threat of a German plane notified from up further up the country, we would cease our activities. The lights would go out until the threat of a German plane disappeared, but we were still machine gunned and bombed sometimes whilst we were working.
Generally, how much warning would you get if the early warning system was working?
Perhaps a half an hour.
Half hour. Mm. How was it that you were bombed and machine gunned? Did they?
They used to come. The German planes knew that the Suez Canal was a vital link, and by night, even on cloudless nights, clouded nights, they could still make out the water strip of the Suez Canal, so they didn't need much direction finding. Mm. It was a natural target for them.
Did these bombing and strafing attacks inflict any damage or casualties?
There were quite a few casualties, fortunately not amongst our work team. They used to drop several bombs up and down the canal. They dropped magnetic mines mainly to stop traffic from using the canal, but Suez used to be bombed perhaps on average maybe twice a week, and there were quite a lot of civilians killed, because if the bombs hit crowded out of quarters then there were casualties. But we were lucky.
Were you in the same sort of work gang all the time, or were the gangs picked up fresh every time you went on a shift?
We normally worked in groups of perhaps, as I said, about 8 or 10. Mm. We tried to stay with people that we knew. We knew their method of working. We knew how they liked to unload. But very often we would be asked, and we would receive different members, because our crews did change from time to time. Some people were sick, perhaps, or some didn't like the stress of the work, and they were being replaced by others, so there was a continual turnover of staff.
Where did they come from, the soldiers who were?
Well, they were picked from volunteers from the Cairo area. Cairo is a very large area, and there were infantry regiments, there were service corps, there was the armoured regiments, there were two or three regiments, there was the 8th Hussars, or the remnants of the 8th Hussars, the 7th Hussars. There was quite